Basically, it's the same thing. And in fact, if you really tried to work out the rhyme business, it wouldn't be so trivial either. In fact, I don't think anybody's ever done it. You know, I'm not aware of any real theory of rhyme. We just sort of know it could be done. And if you did it, you'd naturally run into plenty of problems. Nobody's paid a lot of attention to the problem because, again, things on the sound side of language are not subject to this irrational dualism. Somehow on the sound side of language, we are able to be more or less sane, you know, and treat questions the way you treat things that happen below the neck. It's when you get to the meaning side that all kind of ideological issues start to arise and irrational dualism starts to enter, and you get into big debates about the notion of entailment. Well, there are interesting problems about entailment, but fundamentally they don't seem any different than the problems about rhyme, which doesn't bother anybody. I mean, not entirely understood, but you'd know how to understand it better. And the same seems to be true about entailment. We have plenty of evidence, reliable evidence, about semantic properties of expressions and semantic relations between them. Like any evidence, it could be wrong. You know, you never know that evidence is true, even in physics, and certainly here. But we have fairly reliable evidence. You can replicate it. You could sharpen it up if you like. You could, you know, do statistical tests and dress it up as much as you please. And there are even some theories about it. And the problems that remain, at least from a naturalistic point of view, are not different in principle than the problems that arise about rhyme. That's the point I want to stress. Now, notice that an I language itself, the I language itself doesn't tell you whether these formal relationships are rhyme or entailment or something else or nothing. There are all kind of formal relationships between sets of properties. In fact, you could imagine another creature which has an I language just like mine, but it's linked up to performance systems that guide locomotion, okay? So that if the performance system produces a seven-word sentence, the person walks off in that direction. And if it produces a 12-word sentence, it walks off in that direction. And if it produces, a WH phrase, it walks faster or something like that. I mean, you could, it's perfectly possible to imagine an I language which is a set of instructions for locomotion. Well, in that case, these formal relations will still exist, but they won't be rhyme and entailment. They'll be some other thing. The relations are rhyme and entailment because of the way the whole language faculty is constructed. We're talking about a physical object, remember. It's a physical object, there being no other kind of object. It's an object, in short. As an object, it has its own structure and properties. It appears to be the case, best we know, that its properties are it's a cognitive system embedded in performance systems where the cognitive system yields infinite sets of instructions which have formal relations between them that are interpreted or acted upon, manifested by the performance systems in ways that yield the phenomena of rhyme, entailment, and so on. Yeah, that just seems a descriptive, as best we know at least, that looks like a true description of the language faculty and language use. Okay. And a point to stress, no philosophical question, for a naturalist at least, no philosophical questions arise in the case of entailment that don't arise in the case of rhyme. Okay. All that arise are empirical questions of varying difficulty. There are many, this is roughly what at a very rough way, what a naturalistic picture yields. I would like to look in more detail at it later, but let's stop there and ask the general question. Start looking at the general questions. The most general question is this the right way to proceed at all in the study of humans above the neck? Should we proceed in this fashion? And that breaks down into a number of sub-questions. All of which have been raised. I'm not raising them. This is considered highly controversial, I should say, if not totally absurd, you know, by people who think about these questions, not by the people who do it, but by people who think about it. In fact, it's almost universally thought of as either highly controversial or even absurd. In the domains of thought, mostly philosophy of mind, that are concerned with these issues. So we can ask various questions about, maybe they're right, what kind of question can be asked? Well, one question is whether it's improper or even controversial to describe the brain in this fashion, apart from questions of truth or falsity. Is there something improper about using such terms to describe the brain? That is it controversial to describe the brain as a system that has states, say? Apparently not. I mean, we describe every other system as something that has states, so that doesn't seem controversial. Well, is it controversial to say that these states have properties? Well, again, we do it all over the place, so that wouldn't seem controversial here. Is it controversial to say that one of these properties is being a generative procedure? Well, that can't be. This is one of the best understood properties there is. There are very few properties that are as well understood as that one. So that can't be controversial. And proceeding step by step, there doesn't seem to be anything controversial in the moves that have been made. We're saying the language faculty, the brain is implicated in the language faculty. Apparently a part of the brain is. That part of the brain has various states and subsystems. Here's a proposal about them. Those subsystems have various states that they go through. The states have certain properties, like the property of being a generative procedure. We're all within really quite well understood notions. Nothing, in fact, as well understood as natural sciences, so far at least. So that part can't be controversial. If there's some problem, it's lying somewhere else. The second kind of question that can arise is whether the results are correct. Is the story true? Does the brain have this architecture? Does it have these states and these subsystems and these properties? Well, that's where the substantive issues arise. But we can put that aside for the moment. That's not the kind of objection that's being raised. The kind of objection that's being raised is not, look, you made a mistake. It's a different kind of generative procedure. That's the kind of debate that goes on internal to the assumption that it all makes sense. Okay. So somebody writes a paper and it says, no, your generative procedure is wrong. It should be that one or some other thing. These are where the questions of truth and falsity arise, but they're not relevant here. A third kind of, and they will be as we proceed into it, but not at the general level. A third kind of question that arises is whether there's some alternative. Is there another way to look at language and the use of language which would, say, have better results or a broader reach or lead into other areas that are not reached this way and so on? Well, anybody with a naturalistic temperament will keep an open mind about that, obviously. And in fact, we'll expect that it's probably true. I mean, it's always been true in the past in all the sciences that everything has been wrong. So therefore, it's probably true today that everything's wrong, and we await being shown some better way to do it. But that itself is not terribly interesting, because that's the normal state of inquiry. The question is there some alternative around that we can evaluate? Well, as far as I'm aware, there isn't. I don't know of any alternative to evaluate. So therefore, doesn't seem that there's anything to look at. In fact, if we look at other approaches, like, say, sociolinguistics or whatever, if we look at them carefully, it always seems that they presuppose all of this. I mean, they may not talk about it much, but if you sort of, you know, you kind of lay out carefully what they're doing, they always seem to be presupposing exactly this. And if you try to reconstruct them without presupposing this, you really reach absolute nonsense. That's true even of people who deny it. People often deny what they're doing. That's not unusual. And it seems to me if you look at the actual work in sociolinguistics or any of the other, you know, field, anthropological linguistics, you invariably find that all of this is being tacitly presupposed. We could talk about that if you'd like. But I'm really not aware of an alternative way of proceeding that's been proposed. So the third subquery doesn't get you anywhere. There is a class of questions about whether the notion I language comes close to the common sense notion of language, and whether having an I language, meaning having a cognitive state in the state L, where L is the I language, whether that comes close to knowing a language, having knowledge, and so on. In my opinion, it comes pretty close. That is, I language is pretty close to at least one common sense notion of language, one standard common sense notion of language, which appears in the traditional literature commonly, is that a language is a way of expressing your thoughts. To have a language is to have a particular way to express your thoughts. Well, that's pretty close to I language. As for having an I language, that to me seems to come very close to having knowledge. Now, it's very remote from philosophical theories of knowledge, but I think which are usually phrased in terms of abilities, dispositions, relations between people and propositions, and so on. But in my opinion, those theories are just all flat wrong. They have almost nothing to do with what we call having knowledge. So not being remote from them isn't a big problem. It is very remote from standard theories of knowledge. I don't think it's very remote from the notion of knowledge as it's actually used. Like when we say that somebody knows the construction business or knows his way around Girona or something like that, that seems to me very similar to this notion of knowledge, though very remote from philosophical theories of knowledge, and certainly not expressible in terms of dispositions or propositions or anything of the kind. However, whether that's right or wrong is not very important, because it just doesn't matter a lot whether the concepts we come up with closely match those of common sense discourse any more than it matters in the case of energy or undecidability or angular velocity or whatever you pick. I mean, you pick the concepts that you need to make sense of things. If they're not close to those of ordinary discourse, so much the worse for ordinary discourse, which is fine for its own purposes, but is not available for the purposes of reflective, rational inquiry. So that's not a real issue. Well, let me now, I kind of lost track of time. What time am I supposed to stop? Well, I mean, half past five. Okay, well, let me just say what I'd like to do next, and then I'll stop and open it up for discussion. What I would like to do next is to turn to various approaches that reject the entire enterprise. Okay, they say the whole thing is wrong from beginning to end, and insist on what I would call a dualist approach. This meaning now methodological or epistemological dualism, some kind of non-naturalist dualism. Now, I want to stress in advance that the advocates of the approaches I'm going to be discussing would never accept this characterization of their position. In fact, almost invariably, they regard themselves as hard-headed scientists. So they would completely reject what I'm saying about them. I'm going to try to argue that they're anti-naturalist, Quine, for example, that it's radical, that everything that comes out of that tradition is a radical departure from naturalism. And obviously, Quine wouldn't say that. He regards himself as the prototype of naturalism and regards this as mysticism. And I want to suggest that it's the opposite and that it goes across the board, covering virtually all philosophy of mind and cognitive science in the reflective sense, artificial intelligence, and so on. Okay, that's the topic I want to turn to next. Let me stop. Not nonsense.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
If we don't have reduction in this extreme sense of the data, we will not have
unification. Unification, but not reduction, which are two totally different things. You started by saying that the history of science is one of unification, efforts at unification, and that's certainly correct. But you then said that it's that everybody sensible regards the project as reduction. That's just false. In fact, the history of science is not one of reduction. I gave one example this morning. If you take the classical original moment of modern science, namely Newton, you had Kepler's laws, which describe planetary motion. You had the mechanical philosophy, which was the lower level theory. And it was not the case that Kepler's laws were reduced to the mechanical philosophy. In fact, what happened is they threw out the mechanical philosophy. Okay. Now, there was a unification, but the unification came by throwing out the lower level and recasting it totally in terms of universal gravitation. That's not the only time that that's happened. I mean, if you look at, say, chemistry and physics, see, it's true of biology and biochemistry. That was a case of reduction. But if you look at chemistry and physics, it wasn't. The physics of the 19th century was, in fact, incapable of accounting for the chemistry of the 19th century. And the physics of the 19th century had to be radically recast, namely turned into quantum theory, before it could begin to deal with the chemistry of the 19th century. So the end result, looking back, was not reduction, if you like, it was expansion. I mean, the more basic subject, if you want to use that metaphor, was radically modified, and if you like, expanded, to incorporate quite well-established phenomena of chemistry. I mean, the periodic table, for example, was well-established, just wasn't understandable. The differences between states of matter were well established but unintelligible. Physics had to completely recast itself in order to solve the unification problem. Now, you never know in advance how the unification problem is going to be solved or if it is going to be solved. After all, it's just kind of a faith in unity of nature that leads us to believe it is going to be solved. I mean, that's not a doctrinal principle. It could be that the world is fundamentally dualistic. About 90% of the matter in the universe is supposed to be dark matter, about which hotshot physicists tell me they don't know anything. Okay, so if Vicky Weisskopf is correct, 90% of the matter in the universe we don't know anything about. Well, suppose it turns out it follows different laws. Okay, surely crazier things like that have happened in modern physics, and I don't think any serious physicist would rule that out a priori. Well, if it follows different laws, there isn't going to be unification. There may be unification, but not reduction. Now, we don't know in advance, unless we're dogmatists, we don't know in advance whether there will be unification or whether, if there is, it will be reduction or change in the so-called more basic science, as has often been true in the past. So I don't agree with your first statement that the history of science is one of repeat steps towards reductionism. Now, going to the three points, take the Cartesians. They had a concept of unification. It was not a concept of reduction, but that doesn't make it non-naturalist. They claimed that the world was a certain way, that the world was consisted of two substances, a extended subject substance and a thinking substance. And they were very much concerned with the problem of unification. In fact, there's a whole debate that goes on for a century about this, you know, about how it's called the problem of mind-body interaction. You know, is it pre-established harmony? I mean, did God set it up going that way? I mean, all of those are efforts to deal with the unification problem. And there are all sorts of theories, not by stupid people. I mean, Leibniz was not a stupid person, nor was Malebranche, and not an inconsiderable scientist either, Leibniz. They were dealing with a hard problem of unification. It turned out they were dealing with the wrong problem because at least one of those substances didn't exist, namely body. Newton showed that body doesn't exist, so therefore there was no problem of interaction. As to whether the second substance exists, we really don't know. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But so far we have no evidence for it, because the only evidence for it was that it didn't appear to fall within body. But since body doesn't exist, that's not an argument any longer. So post-Newton, so it's just, I don't think it's true to say that the Cartesians were opposed to unification. It's true that they were opposed to reduction, but that's because of their conception of the nature of the universe, which could have turned out right, consistent with naturalism. Though once Newton came along and destroyed body, it was gone. Your second point was that our goal is reduction, and I just don't agree. It's never been that. The goal is unification, if it's possible. Unification may require radical changes in the more fundamental subject, as has often been the case in the past. It was the case at the classic moment of the origin of modern physics, namely Newton. It was the case in the most recent revolution, namely quantum theory. And there are many other examples. You know, you take a look through history, there have been plenty of cases where unification was achieved by often radically modifying more fundamental subject. As to rejecting the physical, I'm not rejecting the physical. I'm saying there is no such thing. I mean, the problem is not that the ideas they are talking about in the physics department are unstable. That's not the problem. The problem is that the guys in the physics department are not suggesting any notion of physical. I can't go to the physics department and say, ask Vicky Weisskopf, tell me what the physical world is. All he can say, look, my best guess about the physical world is these are some of its properties. Well, it happens, and the physical world is just the world. You know, it's not that there's a world and then a physical world. There's just the world, because we don't have any way of talking about the physical world any longer after Newton pulled the rug out from under that by eliminating the notion of the physical. So all we have is the world, and the world has its properties, and the physicists say the 19th century physicists understood some of them, and the 19th century chemists understood others, and the 19th century biologists understood others, and in fact the 19th century psychologists and linguists understood others. Some degree of unification has taken place in all sorts of directions, but there never was a notion of the physical world. It's not that, I mean, if a chemist drew a picture of an organic molecule and made some predictions about what was going to happen on the basis of its structure, it is just untrue. It would be absurd to say that the chemist wasn't describing the physical world. Of course he was describing the physical world. No physicist could tell him what he was talking about. And in fact, it wasn't until Pauling that they even knew what a chemical bond was in terms of existing physics, because physics had changed. So it took, you know, like almost a century before a physicist could say, oh, that's what you're talking about in my terms. Reason being, physics was just inadequate. But from that, we would not conclude that the chemist wasn't talking about the physical world. That would have been absurd. Of course, organic chemistry was about the physical world, and the periodic table was about the physical world, even if the concepts of physics at the time were incapable of capturing these properties of the physical world. And in fact, as we know in retrospect, they were literally incapable of it. They were wrong. They had to be radically changed to capture it. And it seems to me that today we're in the same situation with regard to, say, what are called mental properties. Exactly as Priestley said, these are like electricity, magnetism, and the properties of attraction and repulsion, which at his time nobody understood at all, but they were all properties of the world, that is, the physical world, there being no other. And we have to try to find out what properties of matter yield these effects. And that's the psychologist is in the same situation as the chemist in this respect. There is no notion of physicalism. I'm not rejecting it. I'm saying I don't see anything to reject unless someone can come forth with an account of what the physical is. There's nothing to reject, so I'm not rejecting it. As to reductionism, it's just a false goal. It has not been the right goal in the past, and there's no reason to think that history's changed. If it wasn't the right goal in the past, there's no reason to believe that it is today. And as for the historical point, it's correct that the Cartesians didn't seek reduction, but they did seek unification, and that's a naturalistic goal. It's just false of history. It's false of history, and therefore it would just be dogmatic to maintain it today since it's never been true in the past. I mean, not never. There are cases of reduction. Crick and Watson is a case of reduction. But quantum theory is not a case of reduction. You're absolutely right. I mean, except I haven't even given arguments against behaviorism. In fact, I haven't given arguments against anything. I haven't talked yet about the notion of public language. I'll come back to that. But I will suggest, looking ahead, that there is no notion of public language. There's no intelligible notion of public language. You're right, I haven't given any argument against that. But I will try to do so as we proceed, because my feeling is that the notion of public language makes about as much sense as geographical region. That is, to ask whether, say, you and I and, you know, some North American up in the back row speak the same language, English, is about like asking whether Boston and New York and London are near each other as compared to Tibet. There's no answer to that question. It's any answer you like. And I think that's what turns out about public language. I think it's just a misunderstanding. It's a misunderstanding of the notion of similarity. But you're right, I haven't given any argument. I'll come back to it. Well, I haven't discussed. Well, Lewis has a funny position. I was thinking of Lewis's article, Language and Languages, in which he takes a very strange view. He takes the view there that there are two notions we understand. One is the notion formal language, class of expressions. The other is the notion community language. Okay, that's the language people use. And then he says he finds extremely mysterious the notion that I've called I language. Okay, that he feels really is perplexing and raises philosophical issues and so on. And in my opinion, he's got it exactly backwards. The only notion that isn't perplexing is I language. That's like being a chicken. No more perplexing than being a chicken. The notion that is completely perplexing is formal language, because no one's even given a hint as to what it might be. And as to the notion of community language, I mean, you know, it's not perplexing, like being near London isn't perplexing. If somebody says, I was near London yesterday, I'm not perplexed. I understand, you know. But it's not a notion of the sciences. Whether you're near London or not is a matter of your interests. And whether you're speaking a community language is a matter of your interests. As the interests shift, the community language will shift, and in any arbitrary way. I mean, whether my brother and I speak the same language has no definite answer. We're different in some respects, we're the same in others. And every linguist knows that this just spreads out all over the place. I mean, it's like geography. It's as continuous as geography. You know, and to try to look at geography and say, look, there are real areas in the world. You know, there's a real area near London, such that everything's either near London or far from London. Well, everybody knows that doesn't make any sense. But to try to draw an area around Catalan doesn't make more sense. Except by accident, you know, accidents of conquests or rivers or, you know, television stations or something like that. But apart from historical accidents, you just kind of have a, you know, you just have things spreading all over the place. As far as we know. I will come back. I've given an argument. But with regard to Lewis, the conclusion that I'd like to come to is that the two notions that he thinks are intelligible, one of them is just uncharacterized formal language, so we can't say whether it's intelligible or not. The other, community, language used by a community, he explains it in terms of what he calls shared norms. But that just raises more problems. I mean, he's thinking of a language as something that's, you know, defined by a dictionary and the grammar that somebody wrote. And that's not what languages are. This is a funny idea that a lot of philosophers have. I was just in Oxford, where I was talking at philosophy department and philosophy lectures about similar topics. And after one of the lectures, I talked for a while to a very distinguished Oxford philosopher of language, I won't mention his name, who told me what I know they all think, you know, but I've rarely heard anyone say it, that the only real language around is Attic Greek. And the reason is it has a closed corpus and somebody wrote down the rules. I mean, the only reason he didn't mention Gothic is because they don't study that at Oxford when you're a student. But that would have been another real language, because that's what they mean by language. They mean something which is a closed corpus and has fixed rules that somebody laid down, or maybe what you do in the Oxford Senior Common Room. Well, you can have that in mind if you like, but then don't pretend you're talking about language. Language has nothing to do with that. Attic Greek isn't a language at all, you know. I mean, it doesn't even have the properties of a language. I mean, it's true that somebody wrote down a set of rules for it, but those rules are just things you teach students under a certain authoritarian system where you're trying to drill something into their heads. I mean, it's a system of authority. It's not a language. If you want to study certain systems of authority, fine, study those. But don't confuse other people into thinking you're talking about language. You're not. Now, when Lewis says that a language is something shared by a community who observe common norms, I think what he means is the norms that are given in, you know, the Oxford English Dictionary and Fowler's English Usage. But that's just an authority system. It has nothing to do with communities.
Do I understand you right? If I say that when you depart from dualism, you are not falling back into any kind of monism either, because it wouldn't make sense for you to talk about monism.
Again, my understanding is that since Newton's revolution, all the questions have disappeared. I mean, it's monism, if you like, but in a non-interesting sense, there's just the world. So it's monistic, if you like. But there's nothing else that we can say. I mean, Newton, I think it's insufficiently appreciated that Newton pulled the rug out from under all of our intuitions. He said that our basic understanding is wrong. The mechanical philosophy, which is our basic understanding, and was also his basic understanding, just seems to be wrong. Well, as I mentioned, Newton had a lot of problems with that. He regarded it as highly paradoxical. Tom Kuhn, for example, suggested in his work on Newton that one of the reasons he called his work Mathematical Principles, not Principles of Philosophy, which is what science would have been in those days, is because he didn't really believe it. You know, he was willing to call it Mathematical Principles because, well, okay, it was mathematical principles that worked. But it didn't reach the level of natural philosophy, meaning truth about the world. That's Kuhn's interpretation of the somewhat unusual choice of title. But whether that's true or not, we know from Newton's correspondence and other things that he was extremely disturbed by the apparent conclusion that he was led to postulate something, universal gravitation, which, as he put it, no rational person could possibly believe, or, you know, in his words, no person trained in philosophy, meaning rational, could possibly believe any of this nonsense. But he was led to it. And ever since then, we just have, our intuitions about these matters are gone. All we have is the notion, best theory. Try to find the best theoretical explanation. Try to unify as much as you can, because we'd like to have unity rather than disparity. And that's it. There's no longer any intelligible question of physicalism or dualism or monism or anything else, as far as I can see. I admit that people talk about it all the time, but I don't think it's intelligible. I think it's an insufficient appreciation of the collapse of our intellectual universe at that period.
In that theory of sense, probably, you may talk about monism and as well about pluralism.
Yeah.
For example, you could say that the natural sciences in the 19th century were highly pluralistic. I mean, you had chemistry over here, and you had physics over here, and they didn't have a lot to say to each other, you know. And you had biology over there, and you had even less to say. So it was highly pluralistic. But of course, you know, not metaphysically so. It's just that they hadn't, you know, they were all so wrong that they hadn't yet figured out how to merge. In fact, the one that had to change most was physics. Well, we certainly have it for normal life. In normal life, we would all agree that I speak English, I don't speak Catalan, Luigi speaks Italian. When he speaks English, it's not quite English the way we speak it where I come from. We all say that. The trouble is we all know that it has no absolute meaning. I mean, I don't speak exactly like my brother. My children don't speak exactly like me. If we travel around the thing called Italy, especially, say, 100 years ago, you know, you're going to get all sorts of things. You don't know whether they're Italian or not Italian or whatever. English is a misleading case, which I think is one of the reasons why philosophy is misled. Most of it's in English. But English is misleading because it happens to be artificially isolated, you know, for all kind of historical reasons. I mean, it doesn't have quite the range that you have across, you know, the Germanic-speaking area or the Romance-speaking area. I mean, because of the English Channel and because of, you know, powerful armies and genocidal settlers and things like that. But those are historical accidents. I mean, if you took, say, what's now the United States, 500 years ago, I mean, there were thousands of languages. Whatever language means. There was just a huge linguistic diversity. Now there's one sort of one language. But that's just because a bunch of genocidal maniacs conquered the continent. There's nothing about linguistics in that. Yeah, you kill everybody off, you got one language left. Okay, big excitement. There's nothing else that can be said. You know, I mean, for normal life, sure, we can do it, but we can do it in all kind of ways. When you try to make, I mean, I'm, you know, you can tell me better than I can tell you, but if you take, say, the Romance area, to decide to call this a language and these different languages isn't going to mean anything. In fact, you know, first day of any elementary linguistics course, the students are told, they're usually told a joke that goes back to Max Weinreich, who said that a dialect is a language with an army and a navy. Okay, and then the next lecture, they're told dialect doesn't mean anything either. And in fact, if linguists thought about it, the third lecture, they tell them idiolect doesn't mean anything either. That's not to say that we can't use these notions to get around, but we can use the notion near Barcelona to get around, too. Like, if I ask one of you, do you live near Barcelona? and it turns out you live in Tibet, and you say yes, and you were thinking of distance to, you know, Alpha Centauri or something, well, you were misleading me. You really do live near Barcelona if you live in Girona. But we know that there's no absolute answer to that. In some other framework where we really were talking about Alpha Centauri, then if you lived in Tibet, you would live near Barcelona. And there's no right answer to that. You know, it's a matter of picking the frame. And you can pick the frame any way. I mean, it's not a matter of vague concepts like baldness. You know, you can't decide exactly when somebody's bald. I mean, is it, you know, 93 hairs? Or that's not like that. This is a matter of hopeless underdetermination. Everything is totally underdetermined by interest and concerns and intentions. And you can set them up any way you like. And any way you set them up, you're going to get a notion of near Barcelona, and you're going to get a notion of near me, meaning speaking something more or less like me. I didn't talk about any of that, but I will. As far as connectionism goes, there's nothing to discuss. There are no connectionist proposals. There have been efforts to construct connectionist models for extremely simple animals, and they abstract much too far away from the facts of neural connection. Now, it's true that there are some areas, usually peripheral processing, where parallel connectionist models seem to be useful. But in these areas, there's just nothing to discuss. It's just hand-waving. As for algorithms, there's nothing... I don't object to cognitive science when it says that some states of the brain have properties which are algorithmic. I think that's true. In fact, I think language is a paradigm example. But the cognitive sciences have gone on in quite a different direction. The computer model of the mind that's used in the cognitive sciences abstracts away from realization in principle. And that's a mistake. I'll come back to that. That's where I think it's going off track. And I think that's another form of dualism. But if somebody says, look, there are certain properties of the world that account for repulsion and attraction, and there's other properties of the world that account for entailment and rhyme, and the latter properties of the world happen to be involve the property of being a generative procedure, well, that's intelligible, and it seems to be true. It's perfectly... When you talked about things known about the brain, a warning flag goes up in my mind. I think almost nothing relevant is known about the brain. I mean, there are lots of things known about the brain. Like, there's an awful lot of blood flowing through it. Huge amounts of blood flowing through it. But it has plenty of neurons. And it has glial cells. And a lot of things seem to be happening all the time. But when you get down below that, it's not true that a lot is known about the brain. I mean, there's some specific areas where things really are known. Like if you look at the structure of the visual cortex, the striate cortex, there's things known, and they're interesting. And some of them seem to be algorithmic and some not. Okay, fine. You know. About the parts of the brain that are implicated in the things we're talking about, basically nothing is known. It isn't even known that neurons are the relevant thing to look at. Well, does yeah. Well, certainly scientists don't. Certainly no scientists have accepted that. Because, in fact, it often turned out that the path to unification was to radically reconstruct the so-called lower levels. About a bet. Yeah, well, you know, if science, most, well, then, you know, you're just talking about different scientists. I mean, some of them bet that it's wrong. I mentioned this morning Roger Penrose, who's, again, a not inconsiderable scientist. And his bet is that quantum theory is wrong enough so that it probably doesn't have the right answers. Well, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. It makes sense, but it's just completely... Yeah. Okay, then they're totally irrational. Because what they're... See, if the view is that everything that's happened in the past is finished, and it'll never happen again, from now on, we're only going to have reduction. You know, it's not controversial that up till now, until very recently, as recently as quantum theory, we have often not had reduction. We have had expansion or change or whatever you want to call it. It's not controversial that through the whole history of science, up until, say, the 1940s, unification often involved radical change in the more basic fields. Now, if a philosopher comes along today and says, well, I think that that's all over, from now on it's going to be reduction, then, yeah, that's extreme form of irrationality. I don't see any point. I understand it, but I don't see any point discussing it any more than if somebody had come along and said that in 1900. I mean, if somebody had said it in 1900, it would have been equally irrational and, like most forms of irrationality, quickly proven wrong. If somebody believes it now, yeah, they're being irrational. It might not be irrational if people really could get, you know, what some people call a theory of everything that was convincing. But even there, you know, the belief that from that so much is understood in the basic sciences that nothing will ever change. That goes well beyond any physicist I know. Unification, that's just a general faith in unity of science. In fact, it's not even a faith. It's a desire to understand. One of the ways you try to understand is to connect things. It's like a point that Nelson Goodman made about simplicity 40 years ago. Why try to make simple systems? Why? Because you're trying to explain. And explanation involves reduction of the conceptual base from which conclusions are drawn. That's simplicity. So if you're trying to understand, if that's your enterprise, you'll seek unification. You don't have any dogmas about it. Maybe the world, maybe dark matter follows different laws. Okay, so that's the way it is. You know, there's no point being dogmatic about it. That would be absurd. But you're going to seek unification for the same reason that you seek understanding. You know, you have genetics over here and you have chemistry over here, and you would like to know whether the properties of one can be accounted for in terms of the properties of the other, just as you seek unification internal to particular branches of a subject. So let's take, say, linguistics. I mean, somebody has a theory of, you know, metrical phonology, something about sound structure, and somebody else has a theory about the way phrases work. Well, you know, maybe there's a principle that underlies both of them. Great. If there is, you'd like to know it, because that would help you understand things. That's why you seek unification. Oh, I don't know. What's the point of trying to understand anything? If you don't know what the point of understanding anything is, get a different field. I mean, people are, you know, humans happen to be curious. Some are more curious than others. Those who aren't curious, there's nothing you can tell them. If they're not curious, fine. You know, then don't try to understand. There's no law that says you have to try to understand. Those who lack curiosity won't try to understand. Okay? It's not that they're bad people or anything. It's like people who don't like to listen to music. Fine. You don't like to listen to music? Don't. You don't like to try to understand the world? Don't. If you do like to understand the world, well, this is the path you have to follow. The I language is an idealization. It's pretending that the state of your brain has one instantiation. See, the language faculty tells you what a possible I language is. Okay, this is what's sometimes called universal grammar. It's a characterization of the possible I languages. Oddly, it looks as if there's only finitely many of them in any deep sense. But even if there's more, the language faculty tells you what the possible I languages are. Now, the thing that's out here is never going to be one of them. The reason it's never going to be one of them is that the data are too heterogeneous. In fact, I said before that if linguists are more serious, they would not only say that languages are out the window and dialects are out the window, but so are idiolects. An idiolect is supposed to be the speech of a single person in a single style. And that's always going to be some crazy historical accident. Like what's called my language, you know, is some crazy mixture of the fact that my father came from the Ukraine and my mother came from Lithuania and we grew up in northeast Philadelphia. And when I was 20 years old, I went to Boston and the Normans conquered England. All sorts of crazy things have led to this funny thing that's in my head. I mean, that's the chances that would be an instantiation of the language faculty are zero. In fact, what's actually in my head is about as interesting for science as the course of a feather on a windy day. You know, it's just some crazy thing. I mean, that's why physicists don't care about the phenomena of the world. You know, they don't try to describe the phenomena of the world. They describe what they would be under highly idealized conditions in which you've thrown away millions of interfering factors. And if we want to understand the language faculty, we'll do the same thing. Well, you know, at the moment, it turns out our level of understanding is not so refined that it matters a lot. But we ought to recognize that as the level of understanding increases, it will matter. I mean, it's like saying that, you know, relativistic mechanics didn't matter for a long time because the scale of things and so on was such that you didn't get those measurements anyway. And the scale of things we can look at now are so crude that the fact that what I have in my head is an unholy mess doesn't matter. But in fact, it's certainly not an I language. Now, as to somebody being multilingual, every one of us is multiply multilingual. It would be inconceivable to be otherwise. I mean, the only way not to be multilingual would have been to have grown up in a completely homogeneous speech community, which is itself an instantiation of the universal grammar. And that's inconceivable. I mean, every one of us has grown up in very heterogeneous communities with all kind of different things going on. I mean, maybe they're all called English or all called Catalan, but it doesn't matter. They're all different. All of us are attuned to interpreting people in different ways. I mean, you listen to your grandmother, you interpret her one way. You listen to your brother, you interpret him a different way. A kid on the street, you interpret him a third way. Sometimes those ways are different enough so that people call them different languages. Sometimes they're not different enough, so they don't call them different languages. But the fact is, everyone, by the time your state has settled, is hopelessly multilingual. The only question is how varied the multilingualness is. And all of this is too close to the phenomena of the world to bother studying. Because if you're serious, you don't care about the phenomena of the world. That's why scientists do experiments and don't just take moving pictures about what's going on outside the window. Because you don't care about the phenomena of the world. You want to understand them. You don't want to describe them. You want to understand them. The way to understand them is to get highly refined examples which throw away all sorts of interfering factors. I mean, it's called idealization, but that's a little misleading because it's getting to reality. The way to get to reality is through a lot of idealization, because you're throwing away interfering factors. You can get down to what's actually happening. And you do as much as you need. It's like when you're doing experiments. You don't do an experiment that, you know, is accurate out to the 23rd decimal place if you don't understand the second decimal place. I mean, unless you need a PhD and you can't think of anything else to do. But if you're carrying out reasonable inquiry, you do your experiments as carefully as you need.